Yeah. Here we are now in the studio. Hier ist die Herrschaft. Heute eine englischsprachige Sendung. Es wird um unterschiedliche Literatur gehen und auch um die Arbeit von Tim Fury, der hier im Studio ist. Tim Fury studiert seit 2008 an der Schädelschule Kunst und kommt aus Cork in Ireland. Yeah, if you like.
So, hi Felicia. I don't when asked to do something for a radio slot, I just without too much preparation, I just thought, well, what could one do? You asked if I could come and you simply would conduct an interview, and on what I thought, or I asked, and you start to ask some questions about maybe how I set off into becoming an artist or something, and I didn't really want to talk about that. I thought it was it would turn into something like therapy. So I thought I could just select some texts that refer to how arbitrary it a choice it is to set out and become an artist or something. So I'm going to read from two books. One is from Closer by Dennis Cooper, and it's from a publishing house called The Serpent's Tale, and the second is from a collection of short stories by Albert Camus. The collection is Exile in the Kingdom, and the story is The Artist at Work. So we'll just see how it goes. The other thing I guess I should say is, in the first place, I thought this slot was going to be late at night, so I'm going to cut short the first extract because it kind of it tears into something like pornography at times. So let's maybe cut that short. So just for all of you that are kind of a little sensitive to things like that,
don't listen to it.
So John, the beginner. John, 18. Hated his face. If his nose were a little smaller, his eyes a different brown, his bottom lip pouty. As a kid, he'd been punched in the mouth and looked grey for a couple of weeks. 6 years ago, punk rock had focused his life. John liked the way punk rock romanticized death, and his fashions made pretty good camouflage. He dyed his hair blue-black, wore torn t-shirts, smeared his eyes with mascara, and stared at the floors of his school like they were movie screens. He never felt more comfortable with himself. Nowadays, punk bored his schoolmates. John stuck it out, but the taunts and the cold shoulders were threatening to ruin his new confidence. One afternoon, he hitchhiked home, grabbed a pencil and paper, wrote down his options. Make enemies. Trouble was, he'd always felt so indifferent toward people. Therapy. That might have meant he was hopeless. Art. On the strength of some doodles he'd done as a kid, and that his mother had raved about it, he enrolled in a life drawing class. John's teacher was fairly impressed. He announced to the class that the work was unique and compared it to the brilliant police sketches. John knew this was only a guess, but attention was just what he needed, so he refused to confirm or deny any interpretation, no matter how stupid. It was the tactic of his favorite band, and it had always worked. The tactic to stay hip. That did the trick. Students would crowd around him after school and kind of hint that they wouldn't mind modeling when he had a moment. He didn't have time to draw everyone, but being picky meant choosing an artistic goal. John couldn't. He didn't know what he was doing. Let me just get this done. Yeah. He wound up selecting the best-looking students because they were fun to deface and pretty easy to bullshit. He just sort of casually say that maybe he was portraying how tortured they were behind their looks, and they'd gasp at his scribbles like they were seeing God or a UFO. One afternoon, a sophomore named George Miles took a seat in John's bedroom and tried not to blink. He'd look so cute. Maybe even a little too cute. Across the school cafeteria, but one-to-one, he twitched and trembled so much he made John think of a badly tuned hologram. John tried to draw, but George was already ruined without his help. I'll take a Polaroid, he thought, in case I become a photographer. Reaching for the camera, he happened to notice the bed. No film. Listen, I've got another idea, he said. In bed, George shut his eyes, went limp, and kind of squeaked. All of which were okay with John. He'd only had sex a couple of times. One standing up in a toilet stall, and the other time with a guy about 50 who'd done all the work while he held his ass open. With George as a prop, he tried a bunch of positions he'd seen in a porno film. He made a lot of mistakes. Like, it took him forever to get his cock hard and enough to slip inside George's ass. But if George noticed or cared, it didn't show. The next morning, John's drawing teacher asked him to stay after class for a few minutes. Wait until the room cleared, then announced that although John, quite rightfully, liked to let his heavy artistry speak for itself, he might use the platform of an upcoming assembly to help enlighten. John tensed up. No way, he thought. In the words of the rock star Bob Dylan, the teacher concluded, eyeing John's clothes, why not shove a glimpse into the ditch of what each one means? It'll count as a test. From being punk, John felt a slight pang of conscience. Punk's bluntness had edited tons of pretentious shit out of American culture, so although John suspected that his work was nine-tenths pretentious shit, he tried to make the quote seriously, despite its has-been author. He agreed to the lecture idea, then spent a month taking notes and rewriting the notes until they didn't embarrass him. At dawn, the day of the assembly, he chewed on a pencil and tried to read what he'd written. Punk orders us to demystify everything in the world, or we'll be doomed to a future so decadent. Atomic bombs will seem just one more alternative, one more aftershave lotion, and so on. What you seem to like in my drawings is how they reveal the dark underside, or whatever it's called, of people you wouldn't think were particularly screwed up. But you should know the real goal of my work is a Dorian Gray type thing. I made you look awful, and I start to look really good. That afternoon, he stood in front of the dimmed student body while slides of his portraits appeared in a giant screen over his head. He was planning to speak after 13 or so. As he studied the mostly bored audience, he couldn't help but distinguish a few guys he'd drawn or still intended to draw scattered through the forgettables. He reread his speech. Thought it sounded like it didn't too much like he didn't know what he was saying. Grabbed the microphone and blurted, "My portraits speak for themselves." Afterward, most of the teachers avoided him. Five students put out their hands. He scheduled a couple of sittings, then chucked a script into a waste basket. He smoked a joint and was wondering what his work might actually say if, through some sort of miracle, its lips could move. Then he stumbled on George vomiting in a restroom. "How'd you like my talk?" John asked. "I didn't go," George replied, looking down at the mess he'd made. "I don't want to know what your work is about." John drew a circle. He added two vertical lines, spaced several inches apart, to make a neck. Facial features appeared on the page as random shaky lines, fine as the hairs on a barbershop floor. They became lifelike through shading. That involved tilting the pencil, then dragging it along the grain of the paper in various directions. Two sloppy ovals came next. John filled them with black blobby shapes that were meant to be pupils, but could have been something he spilled on the page accidentally. John studied the portrait, then George's face, then the portrait, and made his eyes look like caves. It looked more like an ad for some charity. He tried to erase his eyes. The paper tore. He threw the sketch pad aside. "George," he groaned, "let's get undressed." They lay on the bed and put their faces in each other's crotches. At one point, John leaned back and made absolutely sure George was as cute as he thought a few minutes ago. Then he plunged in again. He felt something that could have been love, but was too manageable and too manageable and kind of coldly interesting. It was more like he understood how love might feel. The sensation itself wasn't anywhere as disorientating as love was rumored to be. Actually, it didn't feel that different from having completed a portrait, except George's skin felt so great. That was the weirdest part, feeling how warm and familiar George was at the same time realizing that this kid was just skin wrapped around some grotesque-looking stuff. Huh. That was George's voice. Dan was about to say, I didn't say anything. When you come spurted in his mouth. Jesus, George, he choked. Couldn't you warn me or something? I was figuring something important out. Shit. To keep from causing a scene, he turned his back and sulked. Propped up against the far wall was the portrait of George side by side with a sketch of a previous subject. Even damaged, George's looked better. John scrambled out of bed, grabbed a sketch pad and started comparing the portrait with every other one he'd finished. Hey, he muttered, I've got an idea. Get dressed. They headed for Dump, a poorly lit gay bar well known for its loose clientele. John dropped George off on a bar stool, then felt his way along the wall, squinting. After a few rounds, John spotted someone he liked, slouched in a grey vinyl couch near the video games. The guy wore his hair in a shark fin straight down the top of his head. It looked as stiff as a saw. His eyes were outlined with mascara. His mouth dangled open. The button he'd pinned to his torn leather jacket read, I have many brains, but I can't think. I think I'll stop there. It kind of rolled into something a little more graphic. But I mean, it's maybe even inside of it, the choice of a young guy setting out to pursue something like art, or just having or entertaining this kind of notion, and it's a sort of like a deflection or an excuse, you know, leave me alone. Like, I mean, even I guess you can also reconcile that with adopting like this, like a punk attitude. There lies the slippery slope. All this pretentious shit that he speaks of, he doesn't know what he's doing, but it's still like this, you know, like a defense mechanism. You know, like he'll make these portraits, and yeah, I mean, why should you really explain? You should maybe take a step back and think about it. But like I said, this is a sort of arbitrary, or even in this, that's the choice he makes is sort of arbitrary. And I guess it's more about how that kind of this pursuit. I mean, this is more props you up for the other encounters in life, you know. And here, mostly, what comes down to like sexual encounters and development like that. So yeah, I guess we'll leave that one, and maybe I'll read a little more from the next one.
Mm. But what do you mean with potential shit in this little essay that you, this short novel?
Sorry?
What do you mean by potential shit? There's a potential, okay, this guy is making portraits and he is in something.
That there is potential in this, but this character, he's only doing this to prop him up, you know, to give him some sort of like external glow. Like he does this, he doesn't care about doing it. He's just is that it?
Mm.
Yeah.
So would you say that this guy is in the position to become an artist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how arbitrary it is to set off, you know, like,
arbitrary.
Yeah, like I mean, it's how does someone decide to become an engineer? Maybe you have an aptitude or something that you've been you've excelled or come close to excelling at a sort of tasks that involve lateral thinking or math, kind of a math mind. But apart from having like a very clearly hewn character that points you toward like a craft or an occupation, how does anybody choose? It's an arbitrary choice at some decision. And that's why I thought this was I mean, this isn't explored as a theme, but it's dug out from the very beginning in this short story.
I really like to listen to the till the end of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, because yesterday you started to read the story.
Yeah, which I would have been more comfortable with last night, because it was kind of sprung on me a little about doing something on a radio show. So
the battery was empty,
yeah.
And we couldn't record more, and that's why I couldn't listen to the end. And now you stopped.
Well, I was just a little concerned about the listenership, just in case.
Yeah, but the listener now is also
nobody's listening.
It's also not getting the end of the story.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Maybe it sounds worse if you don't get the end of the story.
Yeah.
But okay. Well, I guess I could just read it. I mean, the other thing about choosing to read on the radio was that, you know, in the depths of darkest winter, you kind of you hide yourself away sometimes. And recently I did. I was not feeling very well and put the blinds down and just stayed in. And I was just thinking that, thinking about this, about radio, because I was trying to stream some audiobook, more for kind of companionship than actually to listen to, just to feel like, you know, there was a voice in the room. But that's what they was say about radio, is what was said about that radio is this companion and television the oppressor, which now I guess kind of comes to internet or whatever. But just listening to a voice and having the opportunity to just have something read for you is that's a pretty nice thing. I don't know how my how I am at reading. I guess I splutter and stutter a bit, but
no, it's
okay.
Fine.
I'll try and I'll read on. So I guess so we just come, so those two guys, they come to a bar and they meet a third. John ordered George to sit down at one end of the couch and took his place at the other. The punk tried to seem unimpressed by their cruising, but eventually turned and he glared at the worst offender. It took him an hour to stop calling John a fake punk, faggot, scum, asshole. George fell asleep. John feigned boredom until the punk started to nod out. Then he mentioned the drugs that he'd stashed in his bedroom. Sounds good, the punk yawned. They made it home. After a few joints, he said John could watch him jerk off. John and the punk and George lie side by side in the bed. They crawled over their bodies while they masturbated, examining each in great detail and making comparisons. Below the neck, they were just about even. Smooth, washed out, skeletal. Face-wise, the punk wasn't much. His eyes were drab, his nose had been broken, his ears were caked with wax. His skull was shaped like an egg. He would have been nothing without punk. John sympathized at first. Then he realized he'd better not care, or he'd never get hard enough. He rolled George onto his stomach, then climbed on top. Tried to get his cock hard, couldn't. Thought he could stuff it up George with his fingers, but that didn't work, so he rolled George over. And he fucked his mouth. The punk sat a few feet off, watching him with a vacant expression that could have meant anything. John tried not to care, but it attracted his eyes like a mirror. When he finally managed to come, his concentration was so bad he missed George and got his sperm all over everything. Shit! A few blocks away from John's parents' place was a cobwebbed mansion that two generations of neighborhood kids had dubbed the Haunted House. It sat far, far back from the street. To reach it, kids had to scale a brick wall, then wade through an acre of dry grass and faded newspapers. Until he was 12, John was too overwhelmed by the words haunted house to check the place out. When he finally tiptoed inside one afternoon, it was nothing, an empty thing. He'd spent a half an hour picking up pieces of broken chairs, used prophylactics and smelly bum's clothes. The morning after the trio with George and the punk, John woke up from a nightmare in which the house had happened to figure. He roused the boys, then suggested a field trip. The punk shrugged, staggered down the hall, came back with a can of John's mother's hairspray and started repairing his mohawk. George crawled out of bed. He was moving a little mechanically, as if afraid he would drop something. "So did you sleep?" John asked. "Bad dreams," George squeaked, then shook his head back and forth to erase the word. "Well, last night was the first time I realized..." forget it. As soon as they'd scaled the wall, John and George fucked in some bushes. Punk watched for a while, then he kicked them until they quit. All three collapsed on the steps of the house, dusty and spent as ghosts. John tried to tell them the story of how he discovered the place. But after a few minutes, George strolled inside and started tapping the walls for possible secret compartments. The punk seemed more interested in the graffiti left over from earlier trespassers. He ran around scrawling the best on the back of his hands with the tip of a burnt wooden match. John ended up on the second floor window, half listening to their racket. He watched a blonde about 8 years old ride past on his bike. John imagined how frightened the kid would have been if he glanced up and spotted a male silhouette. Or how the world gotten so generally ugly and fucked up since he was a kid that a haunted house seemed kind of quaint. "If that's true," he thought aloud, "then so are my drawings. God, I can't think about this." He called the punk and George. The second they entered the room, he ordered them to strip. The punk punched a hole in a wall instead. George bit his nails. After glancing from John to the bloody fist about a dozen times, he stumbled into the hall. John rolled his eyes, crossed his arms and tried to look like he meant what he said. The punk punched another hole, then another, etc. John was deciding to leave when the punk paused, checked out the holes, which formed a crude 5 or 6 foot square swastika. Grinned for the first time that John could remember and started hitting himself in the face and chest. His belt rattled. It was a handful of bicycle chains twisted together and held in place with a rusty combination lock. Once in a while he'd quit hitting himself long enough to spin the dial a few times, squint, yell out some numbers, try the lock again, swear and go back to hitting himself. John was mesmerized. The way he was when he did lots of weird combination drugs. The way he was when he did lots of weird combinations of drugs. I felt like he could control other guys with his mind. In this case, the cuts, the bruises, scabs, and blood smears made the punk look a little like John's portraits. The punk got his belt off, stripped naked, and threw himself onto a mattress that someone had left in one of the corners years back. "Hurt me," he yelled in a hoarse voice. "Fuck me up and I'll never forget you. I really fucking love violence. I want to tell all my friends what we did so they'll hate me or call me a fag or whatever. But fuck them. I'm not a poser like they are. I want to do everything. So when I die, they'll say I lived and tell bad jokes about me. But who cares? I like getting crazy. And you seem okay. Anyway, why not? John thought, if my drawings could talk, I bet they'd say there's something like that. Okay, he said. He rolled up his sleeves and knelt over the punk's heaving back, fanning the BO away from his nose. He took a deep breath, then sank his teeth into the curve of one shoulder. Leave a mark, the punk whispered. Leave marks wherever you want. Make it memorable or whatever. This time John bit very hard. The skin still wouldn't break. Try the back of my neck. When John withdrew, he saw some holes in the shape of a Christmas tree ornament. That's it, he said. I've got an idea. Get ready. The punk balled his fist. John bobbed his way down the back, leaving bites in a regular pattern, four across every few inches. Reaching the ass slope, he paused, massaged his sore jaw. The wounds were really a crass pink, except the ones farther up, which had turned kind of violet. A few even leaked blood in long, thin strands that reminded him vaguely of tinsel. He leaned back a few inches, spooked by the power of what he was doing. He tried to remember the name of the famous artist who'd shot himself and crawled across broken glass in his jockey shorts. He couldn't. This seemed more original, anyway. Doing horrible things to yourself that was just me-generation angst shit from the 70s. A bleeding punk kid was so much more horrific and ridiculous and sort of moving, too. Was that because of the Christmas connection? He thought. He thought it suddenly a pile of chains smirked. I'll make his ass a gift. He pushed the punk's legs apart and adjusted them like an old TV antenna until his ass was roughly the shape of a box. Then he picked up the chains. Each lash left a red ribbon. He tried to aim, but the ribbon still came out too lopsided. So he had to make the whole area red again. He was filling it when the punk got impatient, rose up on his elbows and craned his neck to get a preview. First, his eyes froze on something behind John. It's the cops, he croaked. It was George framed in the doorway, one hand clamped over his mouth. Don't move, John said. George took off. John chased him downstairs and out of the front door. Midway across the yard, John grabbed George's shoulder, ripped a hole in his shirt sleeve and brought them both crashing down in a pile of old newspapers. I want you to know that had nothing to do with us, he puffed. George struggled up to his feet, clutched his left knee and winced. He managed to say, but I thought... Then he hobbled away. John wandered back into the room. It was empty. On the wall next to the mattress he found a fresh swatch of graffiti. Bill was here, more or less. A trail of blood led from there to the door. John followed it down the hall. At its ends, he could just see the punk's silhouette shivering in the light coming through a smashed window. John accidentally stepped on a creaky board. The silhouette tensed, turned, broke a chunk of glass off. That was what was left from the pane and held it out to John like broken glass was a gift. Kill me, the silhouette rasped. I can't feel anything. I mean, you're okay. Shit, I don't know. I guess I've wanted somebody to kill me for over a year or whatever, so don't fucking worry. Do what you want to me. I don't care, really. When I'm dead, you can fuck me as much as you want. I've tried to kill myself lots of times. I just can't. Anyway, nobody knows I'm here. You won't get caught. Stop, John said, waving his arms. Wait, I feel... He vomited down the front of his shirt. John bought the latest issue of Art News, hitchhiked home and flung himself on his bed. He surveyed the pictures, read a few scattered reviews. The only name he recognized was Carl Andres, because of the slightly embarrassing scene at the City Museum 3 months before. John had entered its modern wing, seen a bunch of metallic squares on the floor and asked the guard when the insulation would be finished. He'd been brusquely informed that the floor was this man's work of art. Maybe it had been some kind of punk anti-art thing, he thought. He would have thought it was great. But a critic was talking about classicism. No way. John skipped a few dozen pages. He preferred advertisements to articles anyway. With them he could draw his conclusions. Take the puke-coloured painting of some young boy's head in the ad he was squinting at. This artist hated his childhood so much, John mused. It makes him vomit. He gasped when he noticed the work title, Jonah and the Whale, in small print. He'd guessed right. It was the first time that he could recall being right about art, and this shook him a little. Sure, it could have been a kind of fluke, but if it wasn't, and he was beginning to understand art, that might mean he could understand what he was trying to do with his life. What if that ruined his work? What if his drawings weren't really important at all except as places to put his confusion in? And once he figured that out, the inspiration for them would dry up like the wife and kids' fantasies he used to have as a kid. John noticed the word "you" in block letters so large and blue it could have been a kind of summons from God. It was only an ad for the School of New American Art offering critiques to young artists who sent in samples of their work. $50 and an SASE. John stared at the word for a while and decided he might as well mail in some stuff and get some experts to tell him what he ought to do next. He grabbed a sheaf of his drawings, took out several of George, snuck into his parents' bedroom and stole some cash from the drawer where they kept their emergency funds. The following month's only highlight occurred on a Thursday. John had been busy keeping an eye on one particular freshman all year. The guy had a cherubic face. It was meticulous, as though conceived by computer, but in every other way he was a shambles. He talked out loud to himself, walked around in what seemed like a hypnotic trance, claimed that he was a pop star, etc. David always had the unnerving effect that George usually did during sex, or that punk had when John was biting him up. But pending word from the experts, John tried to avoid being overly ambitious. That day they happened to stand side by side at the same urinal. John was so agitated he couldn't start to piss, even from inches away. Even from inches away, David was one of those guys who were so cute their skin looked like plastic or candy. He was oblivious to John and spent their precious few seconds together babbling to the wall behind the urinal about how somebody was following him. It was all John could do not to interrupt. Not that he'd know what to say. He couldn't decide if he wanted to draw David, fuck him, beat him up, or fall in love with him. On the way home from school, John took a detour. He walked through a park. The usual ghosts of themselves were throwing balls in some slow motion down corridors marked on the lawn. Balls stopped wherever. The old guys cheered in their rickety voices. Using his books as a pillow, he lay in his back and watched the clouds move around for a while. He was glad no one he knew was nearby, since he had to admit he found this sky kind of peaceful, despite the clichés that piled up there over the centuries.
What do you think? It's much longer. It's like much longer than expected.
And yeah, but
text probably.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should just finish this, because actually what I intended was not to read the full story in the first place. I could just. But we have time, and I can just.
You have enough time for the other text.
Yeah. But I'm not going to read the full other text either, so. Okay. So, yeah. He let his mind veer all over the place. The sensation was sort of like being chased through the dark by a mob, or trying to chase down a mob that had split up in different directions. He closed his eyes, maybe half asleep. He wasn't sure. When he reopened them, he'd forgotten what he had been dreaming. It was dark. He picked himself up. At the edge of the park, he took a piss on the feet of a statue of some long-forgotten war hero, a granite man covered with bird shit. That night, he was drawing a boy named Simon whose head was shaped like a large glass of milk and some brown turf on top. I can't even read today. I'm fucking shaking. And let's just start again. That night he was drawing a boy named Simon whose head was shaped like a large glass of milk with some brown turf on top, chalky eyes and a mouth of a fish. Maybe it was John's nap, but he couldn't get into the session. They shared a joint, then a beer. Still nothing. John saw Simon to the front door, making various excuses, none of which made any sense. They were waving goodbye when his mother strolled up with a letter for John in her hand. "And clean your room," she said. The letter was one typed page, single-spaced. A Professor James, somebody, like John's submission. He said some stuff that John didn't quite get, but something about straddling a line between confusion and hard-edged realism and passive-aggressive pencil work, and how the drawings were obvious mirror images of the artist. And general words of encouragement. John ran to the phone, dialed George's number and hung up. "What the fuck am I thinking?" he thought. Instead, he ran into his room, shut the door, turned the lock and yelled, "Great!" 1 month and 14 tries later, John had George down. He glanced from a portrait to model and back a few times, ripped the page from a sketch pad and held it at arm's length for George to see. "I think I look like I'm wearing a Halloween mask," he whispered. "That's true," John laughed. "Oh wait, you mean in the drawing?" He double-checked. No, George was too stoned or something. The sketch was an obvious masterpiece in every possible way. John hadn't felt so spooked by anything or anyone since he'd noticed that haunted house when he was 5 or 6. He stripped and walked into the bathroom. The stress of completing the portrait had left him unusually raunchy. He ran a damp washcloth under both arms, across his cock, between the cheeks of his ass. It tried to whistle the tune of the Smiths' "Handsome Devil," but the thing had no melody, so he just sounded asthmatic. He smelled the rag and threw it over the top of the mottled glass door of the shower stall. When he got back to the bedroom, George automatically stripped and lay face down on the bed. A week later, they went through the motions again. George sat on the chair near the window and got that weird look on his face that John decided meant one of two things: "Don't hurt me," or "What's the matter?" John could vaguely remember when George had meant danger. Now he was the only easiest guy to lay hands on. There was nothing intimidating about him at all. Nothing. John put down his pencil and pad. "George," he said, "something is obviously bothering you. Not just today, but in general. So what is it?" George's head jerked. His eyes flicked all over the room. "Everything," he mumbled. John asked again, then wished he hadn't, because George's head gave a last shake or two and dropped back in the chair like he'd been shot. "I'm just completely fucked up," he whispered. "I don't have any real friends. I can't do my homework at all anymore. Sometimes I wish I was dead. Nothing makes sense. Like, my mother has cancer. I don't know what's going to happen to me when she dies. It's nice It's nice to see, but it's nice to see you. But I'm so alone all the time. George went on like that for an hour, despite having made every point he was going to make in the first 30 seconds. John managed to seem like he cared, because the fact that George had any troubles at all was so unexpected. The actual troubles were serious, John supposed, but there was nothing profound about them. Maybe they were a little more nerve-wracking than other pretty young men's. Maybe not. John could hardly be sure, since he'd never been handsome himself. Later they fucked, or rather John fucked George, and kept his eye on the last and definitive portrait, which, luckily, he'd framed and hung in clear sight of the bed. He put George through their usual twists and occupied himself trying to phrase the announcement he knew it was time to make. Words didn't seem that appropriate until they dressed. Reached the front door and promised a phone. "I hope you understand," John added suddenly, "that I'm a much better artist than I am a person." "I don't know what you mean," George said. He rested his hand on the doorknob. "I mean, I've decided to make art my life," John said. "And if I'm going to do that, I can't let myself deal with why you're fucked up. My work's my mirror, like that professor said. I'm weird enough as it is without figuring out why I'm so weird, if you know. I'm weird enough as it is without figuring out why I'm so weird, if you know what I mean." George nodded, turned the knob. "You mean I scare you?" he asked. "No, I mean, I can't see you again." George started trembling. "Oh." John put George out of his mind, which wasn't easy since the guy's face was all over his work. One day he stuffed his drawings away in a bureau, cancelled some upcoming appointments. School closed for Christmas. He spent the holidays drinking himself sick in nightclubs. One of the packages under the tree was a blank book. He described his activities in it. When classes resumed, he enrolled in creative writing. Having reread his entries a few times and mused, "Genius." Unlike John's life drawing teacher, the writing teacher kept up with cultural shifts. Mr. McGough didn't strain to include dated slang in his talks. He was 46, but claimed his life had been changed by the bump in the road to salvation called punk. Jules remembered John's lecture and spent a few minutes one class discussing how clever John's statement had been. John shrugged and let Jules believe he'd calculated the outburst. After that, Jules seemed to look upon him as an equal. They hung out a lot. John guessed Jules was gay. He'd do things like, one night he asked John to name every rock singer he'd like to draw and or fuck. After a few dozen, Jules raised one hand and pinched the bridge of his nose like a psychic. "Your ideal," he said, "is a pale brunette, your age, thin, male, sad eyes, big lips. His nose is perky. His ears might as well be invisible, they're so attuned to his face. Like the handles on something one lifts to one's mouth when thirsty." Jules talked like that because he was a poet. One of his best poems included this image: a boy's screaming countenance faced the horizon, emitting a fresh brand of sunlight. Vaguely inspired, John hitchhiked home that day, the day he had read it and made a drawing. Jules liked that. Next thing John knew, they'd begun a collaborative project in pictures and words. Jules arranged, with John's punk roots in mind, to hang their work in the janitor's closet, which, as it turned out, was much roomier than John had thought. Sometimes when Jules finished a poem, John would stay up all night adding the smudges and smears to an earlier drawing until the two seemed to relate. Other nights he'd erase part of a portrait and give Jules free use of that space. By sticking to George, John not only recycled old stuff, he gave the newer work continuity. it took several weeks to complete a lot of 13. One evening, John laid them out on Jules's living room rug. They clunked their beer cans together. "When this is all over," Jules announced, "let's have a three-way with some jerk." They held their premiere during lunch hour. Most of the faculty drifted through, eyeing their work with suspicious expressions. Among the students who came was a very drugged George. He took two wobbly steps into the room, tried to focus his eyes, and groped around for the nearest wall. Jules studied George for a minute or two, then told John, "That one's perfect for you, and I'd love to watch." "I'm sure you're right," John said, double-checking, but he shook his head back and forth. Okay, that's that.
Perfect.
Yeah, a bit shaky today from the rain, so just apologies if it was a clunky read, but
no, it had really an exertion, so attention.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's maybe, there isn't so much time left, but I was just going to read a little extract from the artist at work. The artist at work. That's what it's called. It's called Jonas or the Artist at Work. And
is it you, right?
No, and actually that was another thing. I could have brought some Myra off, but I didn't. But that's all right. Now we don't really have too much time. But is there actually maybe it makes sense to sort of ventilate something after having read that? I mean, could you follow that? How was that fiction for you? I mean.
Yeah, there are coming different aspects into it. Some key sentences where you understand the point from where the writer is coming, like my work is my mirror. It's something I think it's around the novelist, the short story is around this idea. So that's how it comes to the protagonists, for example, Punk and George and so on.
Yeah. And I think you kind of get the feeling, or maybe it's because you kind of know a little, or at least one can know a little about Dennis Cooper, and it's close to the bone for him. Like these characters,
Cooper is like a punk poet somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, but so these characters even could be him. Mostly, I guess this John. Even though, the role of any fiction writer is to kind of invent roads. invent worlds. That you can. But I think here he takes from the world around him. Like it's not a. So it's kind of like quasi-fiction, but it's and semi-autobiographical. But just back to why did I choose it? It was more a thing just to fill an hour, really.
What about your work?
Oh, well, that's the thing.
Are you writing punk, or?
No, I'm not. No, I don't write so much, but there could have been something that was, there's no point in talking about it now. But this is me. This is my deflection. That's an offering instead of presenting something on a radio, which I think for me is kind of strange. Like I told you, if I was to talk about something, I'd need to point to at least residue of it. I mean, I know you could put. He said we could put images up on a website or something. I didn't know that. Maybe we could do that another time. Maybe with some more time preparation. I feel like I was lamped into doing this. So,
what are you doing with the microphone?
I'm trying to adjust it. I mean, for all I know, people can't hear me. I feel more comfortable when I'm doing fiddling with what's
no,
before
too,
me.
Too far.
It's too far. Oh. I don't know.
It doesn't.
So just cover my face. Nobody can see me anyway.
But you're on the radio.
If you talk to her, she can't sing along.
Okay, but wait. What is really missing in the radio is the mirror.
Yeah.
You can't see yourself, or you people can only listen to it.
Yeah.
And it's a totally different direction into what sense means.
Yeah.
Because that what you need as an artist
yeah.
is a mirror, or
yeah.
you're creating a kind of mirror. In the radio, you don't have that. You can talk about mirrors over hours.
Yeah, you were talking about mirrors the other night.
Yeah.
I wasn't. I was just a bystander.
Yeah, and you can explain what art is through reflecting on mirrors, a reflection on it. But in the radio, yeah, you have only the reflection without a mirror. So how do you deal with that? Probably that's why
something
you
to amuse
wanted to come closer.
On and over till next time. I'd love to kind of go like, you know, same time, same place.
What place? Here.
Where are we?
Studio.
Oh yeah.
Oh, but.
But
yeah,
we should wrap it up. It's coming close to the hour. It went by very quickly, actually, didn't it?
Yeah.
But
but you read the story over an hour.
Yeah. That's fine. I mean, that's sort of a coherent thing to do, to read. From start to finish, the story.
Yeah.
Even though, I also apologize for the clunky reading.
So now
but,
I'm missed.
Have you got a an exit song, a song to see us out?
To exit.
Yeah. I didn't. Yeah, I was going to bring in.
You can
the
tell
slits.
Me something. I can search for it.
Oh, it's all you're on the
internet.
Yeah.
It's called.
It's called the internet. Yeah. But I'm blank. I don't listen to.
Internet.
Maybe we should kind of drone out.
So what do you want to hear? What do you want to like to play? But I think it's really a good idea. So now because I asked for the end of the story, I didn't get the second text. So.
Well, I mean, I don't. So you don't know this. I mean, okay, this was a French writer. Now this is translated in English. I'm sure maybe you read it, if at all. If you did read it, read it in German. But you know, it's. Exile in the Kingdom. It was a collection of short stories by Albert Camus.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's the one where the renegade and of Deutsch, I don't know what the... but in it, it's also like a criticism of someone kind of a guy named Jonas, who also has no idea what he's just... with what to do with himself until he's kind of pushed on a path or... into like painting, and he's locked away, and he just paints and paints and paints and paints, and a dealer takes care of everything, and then he just paints himself into submission, into some savage sadness or something, you know. It's just I just thought of these when you know, I was kind of like trying to deflect away anything that was telling of me, but that they related a bit, like it's the
so
perhaps next time
next time
come and then you know, with these extracts or these whole stories splurted out they and strung together them some kind of sense or well might emerge. So we can see.
Yeah. So here in a Wikipedia article, it's described as Albert Camus text, the artist who works Jonas, as an artist who has had a poor and unnoticed career. That's an interesting subject for the next show.
Yeah, I don't want to.
An unnoticed career.
Yeah, yeah, but that's the guy does. That's wrong because he is noticed. I mean, he's unnoticed. His work goes like he goes and goes and goes and goes. But Hmm. Yeah, in my mind, that's the storytelling of what it was to be an artist. Or maybe that's what, just because it didn't come into celebrity doesn't mean, you know, like, what does it say? What does it say? It's on a, anyway, don't believe everything you read in Wikipedia.
Suddenly gains a patron.
Yeah, he gains a patron, so a way to go, so like something, the cyclical or something keeps him going. And
then a show in a good gallery.
Yeah, see, that's the key. Yeah.
Okay, but, I think I play now the song we started with.
Oh, yeah? Play the same song again?
Yeah.
Carbon Copy. What was that song, by the way? I didn't...
Abner, J. Abner. Now you need headphones.
Oh, yeah?
But,
okay, thanks for having me, and maybe we'll come back.
Wait. Yeah.
I'm not shaking in it.
Thanks.
Where?
Hey, yeah, thank you for being here. And yeah, hopefully we have another show.
We'll push it along. Yeah, sorry. Sorry. Are we off the air?
Timothy.
Are we off the air?
Yeah, we're off here.
Are we off the air?
The poor, the rich, the black, and the well-to-do. Oh no.